All glories to Simal devotees. All glories to Sri Sri Gauranga Sri Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritam Naram Jayvam Narottamam Devim Saraswatim Vyasam Dato Jayamudirayat Nasta Prayeshu Abhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya Bhagavati Uttama Shlokair Bhakti Bhavati Naishtiki. So we're reading from Srila Prabhupada's Srimad Bhagavatam, translations and purports by him. Third canto, 28th chapter, 17th verse. Apicha darshanam shashvat sarva loka namaskritam santam vayasi kaishore vidyanugraha kataram Apicya darshanam shashvat. Apicya darshanam shashvat. Sarvaloka namaskritam. Sarvaloka namaskritam. Santam vayasi kaishore. Santam vayasi kaishore. Vrityanugraha kataram. Apicha darshanam. Very beautiful to see. Shashvat. Eternal. Sarvaloka. By all the inhabitants of every planet. Namakritam, worshipable. Santam, situated. Vayasi, in youth. Kaishore, in boyhood. Vritya, upon his devotee. Anugraha, to bestow blessings. Kataram, eager. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. The Lord is eternally very beautiful, and He is worshipable by all the inhabitants of every planet. He is ever youthful and always eager to bestow His blessings upon His devotees. Responsively, the Lord is eternally very beautiful, and He is worshipable by all the inhabitants of every planet. He is ever youthful and always eager to bestow his blessings upon his devotees. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The word Sarvaloka Namaskritam means that he is worshipable by everyone on every planet. There are innumerable planets in the material world and innumerable planets in the spiritual world as well. On each planet, there are innumerable inhabitants who worship the Lord, for the Lord is worshipable by all but the impersonalists. The Supreme Lord is very beautiful. The word Shashvat is significant. It is not that he appears beautiful to the devotees, but is ultimately impersonal. Shashvat means ever-existing. That beauty is not temporary. It is ever-existing. He is always youthful. In the Brahma Samhita 533, it is also stated, Dvaitam achyutam anadim anantarupam adyam purana purusham navayovanam cha. The original person is one without a second, yet he never appears old. He always appears as ever fresh as a blooming youth. The Lord's facial expression always indicates that he is ready to show favor and benedictions to the devotees. For the non-devotees, however, he is silent. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, although he acts equally to everyone, because he is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and because all living entities are his sons, he is especially inclined to those engaged in devotional service. The same fact is confirmed here. He is always anxious to show favor to the devotees. Just as the devotees are always eager to render service unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the Lord is also very eager to bestow benedictions upon the pure devotees. Om aginati minandasya gananjana salakaya chaksurun militam jena tasmai shri gurave namaha sri chaitana manuvistam stapitam jena bhutale svayam rupa kadamayam tadati svapadantikam. Lord Kapila has been describing the extraordinary beauty of the Supreme Lord in detail. He's been giving examples of what the different clothing, pieces of clothing the Lord wears, the types of headdresses and armlets and bracelets and bangles and anklets and the different parts of the body of the Lord. These are all objects of deep meditation. In order to meditate on something forever, which is what we are being asked to do, what Lord Kapila is asking us to do, we have to understand what the attributes are and develop a sense of attraction for them. In our daily sadhana, we do this. We practice by making offerings to the Lord, by singing to Him, by carrying out His desires, by studying His words. And in this way, we develop a sense of His nature. And of course, the Lord, in addition to His nature, He has an entourage. He has personal qualities. He has personal aspects of His personal body that we can meditate on. So the whole practice of bhakti is to understand in detail these different features of the Lord's transcendental body and mind, and to develop attraction for them, and to ultimately come to a spontaneous platform of wanting nothing else but to meditate non-stop upon these attributes and beautiful qualities of the Lord. In different so-called spiritual or religious disciplines, there's the phrase love of God, and there's also the phrase universal brotherhood. And one tries to understand what those things mean, tries to understand what kind of conceptions of God are there in different traditions. Or even within the Vedic tradition, there's the impersonalist description that there is only Brahman ultimately and no attributes or features. And in Judeo-Christian philosophies, there's very little information about who this person we're supposed to love looks like. And sometimes there's the image put forward of a kind of stern person who is meeting out punishments and giving awards to people as they deserve them, and of an elderly person with a beard, very wrinkled and gnarled. So these are different kinds of images that are being put forward by people that are still the majority of so-called religious believers of the world, and then there are huge numbers of people who think there are no attributes also, that there can never be any form or any picture of the Lord. So these are kind of like dominant ideas about what God looks like. And people are claiming to be lovers of God or claiming to have some affiliation with a particular denomination or sect or religion, and going to different places of worship and singing psalms and prayers and believing that they'll go to a place after they leave this body where everything will be okay. That's basically what has happened to the state of religion in this world today in Kali Yuga. People are not following, not understanding that there's attributes to God. They're not following the laws they very conveniently said, thou shalt not kill means thou shalt not murder human beings. And so much seva aparad is going on in that realm, killing of animals. And in so many other ways, not following the proper behavior of a human being, drinking and smoking and so on and so forth, and many other things. So, and then, but they are going to go to some place where they'll get salvation at the end. Either they're going to go to a place where they'll, and at the end of life, where they'll get sort of purified by going to the Himalayas or becoming a monk in a monastery or something like that. Or they'll just go to heaven anyway, because after all, Christ is going to forgive us for all of our sins. He says that. So on the day of judgment, I'll just be forgiven and I'll go to heaven. So these are some of the ways that people mistake who God is and what our relationship is to Him and what we're supposed to do as human beings. The information, unfortunately, is very scanty about who God looks like or what He does. So in the Bhagavatam, because it's completely transcendental, it's the person, it's the book Bhagavad, and Spiritual Master and Krishna are the persons Bhagavad. It gives us detailed information of what God looks like and how we can develop this relationship with Him and how we can attain oneness with Him. And oneness, Prabhupada describes later on in this chapter, as having one desire, as having a desire that is the same as Krishna's desire, God's desire. It doesn't mean that one loses one's identity, but the oneness means that we are one in desire. That's the meaning of oneness with God. So one of the symptoms of surrender also is that one should have no desire different from Krishna's desire. There's six symptoms of surrender in the Sharanagati, and one of them is that one should have no desires different from the desires of the Lord. And that is a condition, a very deep surrender, that I want nothing for myself. I only want what Krishna wants for me to do. So the mind, which is the source of all difficulties and our greatest enemy when it's not controlled, becomes one with Krishna's mind. Krishna has certain desires, and when the mind is completely purified, then it has no desires of its own independent from Krishna. So that is the meaning of oneness, and the example that's given, that Prabhupada gives, is the example of Arjuna, who sets the example of someone who has a very independent idea of what should be done as a human being and what should not be done. And he presents all the various arguments of better to not fight, better to not want any adulation, better to not want a kingdom, better not to become embroiled in a fight, that when fighting is not really proper behavior, and so on, and that there would be degradation of the family, and so on and so forth. And in the end, he decides, he's saying to Krishna that whatever you want me to do, I will do. I have no other desire of my own. So this is the example Prabhupada gives of oneness, that his mind becomes one with Krishna in the end. In the beginning, it's opposite. He has his own idea about what he wants to do. And in the end, he's completely transformed. He's ready to go raging into the battle according to Krishna's desires and feels completely satisfied. So that's also, sometimes that's called nirvana, that the mind is dovetailed with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, nirvana. It's also, of course, a symptom of surrender. So when the mind stops functioning in the ordinary material way, then it is made the same as Krishna's mind. So Prabhupada says in his purports that the Lord is always very fresh and youthful. So one of the descriptions that's given in the Brahma Samhita, as it's mentioned, Navayovanam Cha, that Krishna has the appearance of being very fresh and youth. Navayovanam Cha, always like what we see, the evergreen trees, they're always green. So Krishna's appearance is just like always fresh and new. Therefore, no matter how many times we hear about him or look at his deity form, it takes on a newer and fresher meaning every time. Every time we read the Bhagavad, every time we read the words of Krishna or the words about Krishna, even though they're the same words, they appear to be new and different every time, because there's always something new and different about the Supreme Lord. He's never the same to a devotee. There's always something increasing. In the spiritual world, different from the material world, everything is increasing, changing, and growing. Whereas in the material world, things are coming into existence, they're growing, and changing. They reach a certain level, they maintain, they have some offspring, then they dwindle and they die. These are the six transformations of the material world. And the spiritual world, which is constituted not of earth, water, fire, air, bhumir, apo, no, lovayu, kamano, buddhir, but it's made of sat-chit-ananda. So something that is made of knowledge, bliss, and eternity is growing eternally. It never ends. There's no experience of such a thing in the material world. Something that will grow and grow without limit, and never-ending upward spiral, so to speak. So Krishna is like that, and his activity is like that also. It's explained that in the Chaitanya Chaitamrita, that the relationship between Radha and Krishna, or Krishna and the gopis, it is always increasing, it's always improving, it is becoming, sometimes it is said, a million times greater every second. It's inconceivable how such a thing can happen. Because it doesn't happen in the material world. But in the spiritual world, everything is always increasing. So Krishna always looks new, he looks fresh. And if you open the Bhagavad Gita or the Srimad Bhagavatam, anytime, it will be new, even though it's the same words. That's one of the inspirations we're getting for distributing Prabhupada's books. It's time to mention something, because World Enlightenment Day is just a few days away. One of the attributes of Prabhupada's books is that wherever you open them, and if you seriously, anybody who tries to understand what the words mean, will immediately get a sense of peace and tranquility, especially the Bhagavad Gita. People become kind of like, it's very tense in Kali Yuga, everyone's running around. And as soon as they start reading that there's a soul that's transcendental to the comings and goings, the heat and cold and the distress and the happiness of the material world, it immediately brings about a sense of peace. So Just about any place you open Bhagavad Gita, you'll find some very nice verses, like the verse about how the senses are like all the rivers that come out into the ocean but remain undisturbed. People get great inspiration when they read things like that. That, yeah, I'm always disturbed, but here's a book that says, even though you might be assailed by many different desires all the time, pushing and flowing down into your heart or your mind, you can be undisturbed. You can be peaceful. And Matra Sparsha Stakontaya, there may be some troubles, there may be some great pain and distress, but you can still, just like the seasons, you can become transcendental to those things. Just to read that, there's even a science or a system to become free from those things is very enlivening for people to read. So by these realizations, we convince people that they should seriously try to look at these books. And then, of course, we also say that they've made a very big impact on the world, on the body of knowledge of theology and philosophy. They've made a very big impact. They're used everywhere. And they're famous. Prabhupada's books are famous. And there's so many things we can say, and I'm sure all of you know them a lot better than I, different things you can say to convince people. But it's a fact that Prabhupada said once that his books were the law books for the future of mankind. So it's very hard to convince anybody that they're the law books, but we know that it's true. And therefore, we can say things that lead up to that fact, that people are going to live by these books. And Prabhupada did say once that the books that he has written, he was referring to the Vedas, they are like the operation manual for living in the material world. When, you know, you get a computer or a tape recorder or a disc player or something, if you really want to use it properly, you'll read the whole manual all the way through, and then you can get the maximum effect out of it. You can get the maximum advantage. If you don't read it, if you start playing around with it, especially a computer, you can not only mess up pretty badly, you can destroy the whole thing. And anyway, you won't really be getting the maximum benefits. But if you read it carefully, then you can get the maximum benefit. It takes time in the beginning, but you do get the maximum benefit. So similarly, Prabhupada was comparing, this was in 1976, he was in London, he was talking about how these books, they're like the operations manual for knowing how to exist in the material world, which is essentially a conflict situation to begin with. We're living here, but we have to leave here. We like a lot of things, we don't like a lot of things. We're spiritual beings and we're living in this in a material world in a very difficult age. So these books are the guidebooks. They're like the navigation manual to steer us through, to maneuver through this minefield of the material world, so we don't step on the mines and get blown up. That's how important. So even if someone doesn't quite understand the law books, they can tell us how to do things, how to act, and how to make decisions, and you know where to go, and basic questions are all answered. Anyone who's a little philosophical does ask these kinds of questions from time to time, like who am I and where am I going and what is God and what is time and nature and karma and all those sorts of things. So they are a great legacy, and anyone who's joined the Krishna Consciousness Movement, practically everyone, almost everyone without, I don't know, 80% I would say anyway, have done so because they've read Prabhupada's books. I remember even after I met Prabhupada, the first time, my very first meeting, I was so impressed. I was ready to just keep going and hear him and hear him and hear him night after night. But I was able to get a set of Bhagavatams. I didn't even know they existed, but someone told me, oh, you can get Bhagavatams. So I bought them from Prabhupada directly. I was one of the first customers in his book distribution, I think. I didn't have, it was a $15 price for the three sets, three different volumes of the first canto, and so I only had $5, but he gave me all the rest of them anyway, thinking I was going to pay the balance, which I did. But anyway, I started to read them, and I have to say that at that time I became convinced. I wasn't convinced when I met Prabhupada, but I read his books, or the books that he compiled and translated and wrote about. Then I became convinced. Not only that he was an extraordinary person, a great sage, but that he was teaching the absolute truth, which I had never thought. I thought maybe it existed, but I didn't know how or why or what. So that was the notion. I just didn't stop reading the books. I thought, well, this is it. And then Prabhupada became somebody very special. He became the purveyor of this great knowledge. So anyway, I got a little bit off track about World Enlightenment Day, but I wanted to read one section of a purport later on in this chapter, which is about the way in which the mind becomes dovetailed. Prabhupada writes, when the mind is dovetailed to act according to the desire of the Lord, one has attained the transcendental stage. The desire to lord it over material nature is the cause of ignorance. And when that desire is completely extinguished and the desires are dovetailed with those of the Supreme Lord, one has reached the perfectional stage. Upalabdha paratma kasta. Upalabdha means realization. Realization necessarily indicates individuality. In the perfectional stage, the liberated stage, there is actually realization. Nivritya means the living entity keeps his individuality. Oneness means that he realizes happiness in the happiness of the Supreme Lord. In the Supreme Lord, there is nothing but happiness. Anandamaya Vyasa. The Lord is by nature full of transcendental happiness. In the liberated stage, oneness with the Supreme Lord means that one has no realization other than happiness. But the individual still exists. Otherwise, this word upalabdha, indicating individual realization of transcendental happiness, would not have been used. So, even though the Lord sometimes manifests through Yamaraj punishment and reform for the living entity through having to go through a karmic course of what's it called, a rectification, he's always happy. And this happiness is eternal, as is mentioned. So there's another attribute. Krishna is not only always very youthful and young-looking, but he's always very happy. Even when, in the midst of this terrible battle in which friends and relatives were pitted against each other, he was giving instruction, and it's described that he spoke in a smiling way. He never took it as some big human tragedy was coming to exist, but he was always smiling. He imparted these instructions to Arjuna, smiling. And any time we find that the Supreme Lord is giving some instructions to someone, even those who are distressed, he's smiling. Sometimes the demigods, very often, they're distressed. Even though they have a much higher standard of enjoyment, they're distressed because there's enemies. There's enemies everywhere, but the demons are arraying against them and making, they're plotting, you know, how to overtake their kingdoms, how to overthrow them, how to kill them, how to rip them to pieces. So there's an anxiety that exists when one gets a higher standard of life, even in these higher planetary systems. Like in the material world, we have experience. We see people who have amassed a lot of adulation and money. But they're always worried. Like the people who are successful actors and actresses, when they get to a certain age, they don't like to go out in public at all, because people will notice that their skin is getting wrinkled. There might be a few gray hairs if they don't color it. And they don't look the same at all. And then they have a lot of money. They're successful because they're learning how to keep their competitors from getting it. It's like always a constant anxiety. How am I going to keep my competitors from getting it? How to stay one step ahead? So there's always great, great anxiety. Or, you know, someone's going to break into my house or steal my car. So the demigods also, there's always great fear. So Lord Kapila is imploring everyone to become free from fear and develop the same kind of happiness that Krishna has by making one's desire one with Krishna. Then one can be happy internally from within. And it doesn't depend on, well, I had a lot of money today, but the stock market went down the day before and I was miserable. Or I was very successful in one campaign, subduing those who I think are my enemies, but I was defeated in another. But by being internally happy, by understanding what is the thing that makes one happy, that's transcendental happiness or nirvana or samadhi, then one's happy all the time in any situation. One can be rich or poor. And it's very difficult to be happy in the midst of affluence and all sorts of auspicious things, good education, beauty, wealth, aristocracy. Very difficult to maintain steadiness, because immediately one thinks, this is mine, I'm proud, I've taken over, I've won, I've succeeded, I have everything I need, and it's all due to my wonderful talent and brain power. Whereas when one is suffering, then the tendency is to think, oh, now everything has been taken away from me. God is very nasty and very mean. If there is a God, he's taken everything away. But then it's an opportunity for some people to turn to God. And generally we find that they're a little bit more God-conscious when they suffer the dualities of life. So Krishna's always happy, and the happiness is kind of like a son sees the father. Krishna claims, aham bija pradapita, pita mam sarva bhutanam, in different places, I am the father of every living entity. So if he's actually the father, he has this feeling of affection. It's not just happiness, or there's some people around, so I'm going to smile when I see them. But he's always, just like Radharani, he's always like this. I mean, we have this particular mudra here in this temple. Sometimes she's like this. She's holding a garland. But this mudra means that everything is all right, Prabhupada said once. So she's giving that blessing on behalf of Krishna. And she's also saying, he told us once, with this mudra, that I am less than you. I want to confer my blessings on you, so because you're greater than I am, so that Krishna can bestow his mercy upon you. So he's very eager, always beckoning the conditioned soul to come back and enjoy with him, because he can enjoy and he wants everyone to enjoy. And just as it's said here, that the Supreme Personality, Prabhupada says, the Lord is very eager to bestow benediction upon pure devotees. Very eager. Now we're not so eager sometimes to render devotional service, because we think, well, it's very hard. You know, we have to cross the street in the pouring down rain and walk into the temple, or have to go out and distribute books, or get up early in the morning. And sometimes that sense of eagerness or an urgency to go out and spread Krishna consciousness to serve the Lord is not there. It's always there in Krishna. He's always smiling and telling us that we can enjoy. Just we can be smiling all the time, just like he is, if we understand what makes him smile. And that thing is that attitude of eagerness or enthusiasm. It's described by Rupa Goswami as utsahan, utsahan nishchaya darya. Before you can do anything successfully, you have to be enthusiastic. Even in the material world, if you want to succeed, the very first thing you have to do is you have to be full of enthusiasm. Otherwise, you don't get anywhere, right? So enthusiasm, utsahan nishchaya darya, and fully confident that the result is going to come in the end, very sure, absolutely sure and confident, patient to let Krishna take care of the result, eager to engage in various forms of devotional service like hearing and chanting and remembering, always avoiding bad association that will take us away. Now, the people that are always negative, they say that some people are always negative. Like I saw some sun breaking through the clouds, so someone will say, well, it's a partly sunny day, and the negative person will say it's partly cloudy. Or then if the sun's out bright and shining, you say, oh, it's a nice day, isn't it? And then the person with the negative attitude will say, yeah, but it's going to rain. So devotees are always, they're not foolishly optimistic, but at the same time, because they know Krishna is always smiling and eager to get to give blessings, and always willing and claiming to be everybody's father, they have that confidence. They have that confidence that Krishna is going to come through for us in the end. And then a devotee is also very meek and humble by nature. He doesn't, you know, falsely think that I've attained something. I did a great service for Krishna, therefore I'm a great devotee. I should wear garlands and give lots of classes and sing lots of artiks and offer a lot because I'm actually worthy of it. I deserve it. I'm a pretty great guy. So Rupa Goswami tells us that's also another kind of pitfall. Just like in the material world, everybody is very proud of everything that they do, and that's the reason they're suffering so much. Well, even in devotional service, someone can also become, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, a little proud of one's self and one's activity. Prahlad Maharaj was very instructive when he said that we shouldn't think of people in terms of friends and enemies. And in this day and age, we tend to think that way. I mean, we even tend as devotees to think that people who aren't devotees are our enemies. Sometimes we think like that. And those who are devotees are all our friends. But sometimes even we'll find that some devotees will be praising us and everything, and then they'll come into Govinda's restaurant and they'll talk about us behind our back. Oh, he did this, he did that, he did this, he did that. So what our friends are today, they might be our enemies next minute or tomorrow. And our enemies today might be our friends. Those people who are fond of surrounding themselves with friends, so-called, and admirers and followers, often become very dull in their intelligence by having so many so-called yes-men surrounding them. And then they become falsely proud. And then if somebody criticizes them or finds fault, or you could have done it a little bit this way, a little that way, a little better, not necessarily even a big fault, then they go, oh, this guy's my enemy. He's a big problem. Not my friend at all. I shouldn't listen to this nonsense. This is really, really bad. But from the transcendental platform, when we become freed from the thought of friends and enemies, we can sometimes see that these so-called friends are actually our worst enemies. And those who are enemies, seemingly, who are criticizing and fault-finding, that they're actually our friends, because they're telling us not only what we did wrong, but if we're transcendental, we can figure out what we can do better next time. Because, after all, who are we? We make so many mistakes. And let that person be seen as the agent of Krishna, who's telling us, you made this mistake, you made that mistake. Even if we didn't make a mistake, we could have done it better. Well, you know, and this is the mood of the Goswamis, yes. Was it Rupa and Sanatan who didn't want to argue? They said, you know, if we argue with this big Digvijaya, we will even if we defeat them, it'll just be a waste of our time. So friends and enemies, they don't really exist in the material world, and then sometimes friends, they're our enemies, and sometimes our enemies are our friends. But Krishna is always our friend. Suridam Sarvadehinam, he's always the friend of the living entity, because he's never saying anything that is not perfect. And he says in the Bhagavad Gita that anudvegam karam bhaktyam satyam priyahitam chayat svajiram vyasanam chayvat panmayantapa uchite, that if we speak with the properly, that austerity of speech is speaking in such a way, satyam, that one is always speaking truthfully, in a way that is pleasing to others, that is not harmful to others, that is always beneficial to others, and that is always based on Vedic Shastra. That kind of speech endears the living entities to the devotees, and then one becomes dira, janapriyo. One becomes dear to everyone. So a devotee actually doesn't even speak in such a way that someone will consider him his enemy or his friend. Because that's the nature of proper speech. Just like Krishna, when he speaks, he may be speaking in a way, and sometimes that is, well, we were hearing today how Prabhupada sometimes spoke, you know, you're just a little thief. For those of you who weren't here, Sivaspur was reading how Prabhupada would speak in always a beneficial way, even to a very wealthy person. This one man, he called him a thief because he had a big glass factory. And he said that the glass all came from silicone. He said, oh, but who owns the silicone? And he said, Bhagavan. He said, ah, so then you're a big thief. And then later on, he said something that it was, what did he say? It was Bhagavan's property? Oh, yeah, he said, but I also donate to Bhagavan. So he said, Prabhupada said, then, sir, you're just a little thief. But Prabhupada knew how to speak according to time, place, and circumstance. And in the section where we read about Bhishma, how Bhishma was speaking perfect information, even though he was stricken, thousands of arrows were draining all the blood out of his body. He was speaking perfectly. One of the things he talks about, and Prabhupada commented on, is how, as an acharya, he was speaking according to the time and circumstance, that in order to transmit the knowledge of how to be a perfect human being, he was speaking to everyone, to each individual, exactly addressing them according to the way they wanted to be addressed. Like Parthasarathi, he was calling Krishna that, because that was like, it was the mood of the time that he wanted to be addressed like that. It was part of the battle. And Arjuna was also very pleased. So in every case, he was speaking in such a way that people were pleased. They were very happy to hear him speak. So he was delivering the message according to time and circumstance, and as Prabhupada said, and if he hadn't addressed everyone exactly correctly according to the circumstance, then they wouldn't have absorbed the knowledge. So in that way, everyone was happy, even though it was a very pitiful and unhappy situation. Everybody became very satisfied. In fact, it's mentioned in the Mahabharata that when he was talking, Draupadi started to smile kind of sarcastically, sardonically. He noticed it, and he said, "What are you smiling about at a time like this?" So she said, "Well, I just remember when the Kurus were attempting to denude me in their assembly, and you were sitting there, not doing anything, just putting your head down, kind of letting it all go on. And now you're speaking about perfect behavior, and I just thought it was a little strange." So he said, "Well, I want to explain myself." He said, "When I was at their house living as their guest, I had to eat all their food, and it wasn't exactly prasadam. In fact, I felt very contaminated by eating all this food, and my whole system became contaminated, and all the cells in my blood became contaminated, and that's why. But now, that's why I didn't do anything. Almost all the blood has been drained out of my body by these arrows, so I feel I'm getting purified, and now I can speak Dharma, the Bhishma Parva." So it's very difficult to know what to say sometimes, or how to speak, or always be in that mode, or that mood. But Prabhupada did say once, he said that one of the measures of our Krishna consciousness is how jolly we are, how jovial we are. And people appreciate that. It's one of the ways in which we're successful in advancing Krishna consciousness. Like, you know, when you distribute a book, if you're not cheerful and you're not positive when you approach someone, then they're not really very interested. They've got enough travail in life as it is to have someone else come up and try to sell them something that doesn't have a real positive attitude. It's very difficult. So that will naturally manifest in the heart and the mind of a devotee, that attitude, that demeanor of being always very happy. So, you know, yayatamam prabhajane, Krishna says, he rewards us accordingly. If we're very eager, very enthusiastic, and very positive about spreading Krishna consciousness, about serving the Lord, Krishna takes many steps towards us to fulfill our desires. So we'll stop there.